Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. It's an interlull, folks. We are right slap bang in the middle of an interlull. I did think it was going to be a bit quieter. You know, you win against Brighton 2-0. Not the most exhilarating, enthralling performance, but another win, another 3 points on the board, and you kind of ease yourself into an interlull where players are gone away. There's some World Cup qualifiers and people will keep an eye on those things. But from an Arsenal point of view, and certainly in relation to what's happening on the pitch, everything should have been really quiet. And I suppose it is really quiet when it comes to what's happening on the pitch. It's what's happening off the pitch that's creating all the headlines. We ran a story last week about how Stan Kroenke had made an offer to Alisher Usmanov to purchase his shareholding in the club. Just a little over 30% is owned by Usmanov. Stan Kroenke has 67% of the Arsenal shares. And if that bid had been accepted, that would have allowed Kroenke, or would allow Kroenke, to purchase all the remaining shares and take the club private. Now, of course, there are privately owned clubs in the Premier League. You think of Chelsea, for example, and people will say, hey, that's working out pretty okay for Chelsea. You know, they've won some titles, won some cups, won a Champions League. Sorry, fucking Bayern Munich. How annoying are Bayern Munich? I'm sorry. Think about what they did with Manchester United and with Chelsea in the Champions League finals. What a pack of dickheads. Anyway, I'm getting off the point. What I'm saying is that there are football clubs that are owned privately. It's not necessarily, not in itself, a bad thing, but I think in the case of Arsenal, it would be a bad thing if Stan Kroenke were to own it outright. The plurality of ownership that at least provides some measure of accountability would be completely gone. He'd have to provide cursory accounts, nothing more than that. There'd be no AGM, no. He wouldn't have to answer to anyone because he would own the whole thing. So we're waiting after this story comes out. It was picked up by The Guardian. Amy Lawrence provided a bit more detail on the story, and we wait and we wait because the longer it goes without a response from Alisher Usmanov, the more worried you might get. Now, we ran a story on Arsblog News in August 2016 which suggested that Alisher Usmanov was open to selling his shares and moving to Everton, where his former business partner, Farhad Moshiri, who owned part of his stake in Arsenal, they had a company called Red and White Holdings, they were partners. Moshiri has gone to Everton, bought 49.9% of Everton, and the thinking is, of course, that the other 51.1% could be owned by Usmanov at some point. But at that time, after we ran that story, there was a statement issued by Usmanov who said quite categorically that he was not going to sell. He'd purchased his shares in Arsenal, not just for him, but for future generations of his family. That's what he said back in August 2016. So this time around, you're waiting for a statement from Usmanov, because if there's no statement, maybe there's something going on. Maybe there's discussions between the two men. And we waited a little while, and then the story came out. And I think the first thing that we need to say, or I need to say, just to make it really clear, is that I think it's a positive thing that Usmanov has said that he's not in talks with Kroenke about a sale. This is exactly what he said in his statement. I would like to be clear that I am not holding any talks with Mr. Kroenke about a sale. Now, I think there's something quite telling about the use of the present tense there. Maybe it's just me fearing the worst, but it's not a I will never sell to that man. We know that they both don't like each other. There's a real bad feeling between them, but it's not categorical, is it? It's not I will never sell to that man. What's also changed is that his shareholding, which was in August 2016, one which was purchased for future generations of the Usmanov family, is now one that he would consider selling. This is what he said. This is the last line. He said, I would like to assure supporters that I'm open to various future scenarios, a constructive partnership with the majority shareholder, the purchase of his stake either alone or in a consortium, or if a party appears who shares my and undoubtedly the majority of fans' vision for the club, I could consider the question of selling my stake. Now, that is a big, big change in 12 months. from having no intention of selling and wanting to keep his shareholding for his future generations, for his children and his children's 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 children, he's now open to selling. And I think that's something we really should be conscious of. The other thing that's popped up in conversation this week is the character of the people that own football clubs these days. And I don't want to talk specifically about Usmanov. If you listen to the podcast that I did a few weeks back with James Montague, it's titled Billionaires. And we talk about Stan Kroenke. We talk about Alisher Usmanov. We talk about the billionaires that now own football clubs. And it's not just billionaires, it's nation states, it's countries that own football clubs. And I think it requires a certain amount of mental gymnastics from all of us. Arsenal fans have, since Roman Abramovich took over at Chelsea, pointed fingers and talked about blood money and talked about Chelsea being a club that was only formed when he took over, etc., etc. You know, it's part of the way that we view the opposition. But Chelsea fans, do they really care? Do they really care that he made his money in unscrupulous ways? That the close association Abramovich has, and Usmanov for that matter, with Vladimir Putin, is that a problem for them? Maybe it is for some of them, but most of them will look at the trophy cabinet and say, well, that's the price of modern football. We see it at Manchester City, Abu Dhabi, owned by Abu Dhabi, basically, where homosexuality is illegal. Is that a thing that football fans should be concerned about? I think it is. Are Manchester City fans turned away by the fact that the people that own and finance and run their club come from a country where homosexuality can get you thrown in prison? Clearly that is not right. That's not something that we would tolerate in this society, the one that we live in. But the moral quandary you have as a football fan is, do you give up on your football club because it's owned by somebody who you don't like? Paris Saint-Germain, were the fans of Paris Saint-Germain, were they bothered by the fact that it was Qatar that have been bankrolling them over the last number of years, despite all the questions people have about human rights in that country, about the way that indentured slaves are used to build football stadiums? They got Neymar. They might win the Champions League. They'll probably win Liga. So do you care? Does success mean it's easier to overlook the people that own your football club? And I want to be clear, I really don't like Stan Kroenke. I think he's a terrible owner for Arsenal. I think he has displayed almost zero ambition for the football club since he's taken it over, bar maybe one or two articles or statements released through back channels with relatively friendly journalists, and he'll say he's got great ambition for Arsenal to win things. But never once has he demonstrated that. And at the time when it was coming down to Kroenke or Usmanov, it seemed Kroenke was the better man because he was going to let the people who run the club run the club because he didn't know anything about football. What did he know about Premier League football? But, you know, do you need knowledge to have a desire to win and to be ambitious? I don't know that you do. And he has sat far away, and I think there are issues at board level, there are issues at the manager level, that we've seen down the years where perhaps a more hands-on owner, even if he's not involved in the day-to-day running of the football club, he's there to apply the pressure to maintain standards, to say, this is not good enough. If you don't achieve this, then you're out. And I don't think that's happened at Arsenal. I think we've coasted into a comfort zone, and people talk about the players being in a comfort zone, but I think in some ways the manager is as well. Because even if there's pressure from fans, and I don't mean to say that like his life was comfortable last season, but he's had that assurance from Kroenke. Certainly Gazidis is. Ivan Gazidis paid almost £1 million bonus last year. £1 million of a bonus. £919,000, if we're being exact. Bringing his total salary to £2.6 million. I mean, if we'd won the league, if we'd won the Champions League, if we had increased our commercial revenues by a huge amount, then you could say, okay, the man deserves a bonus of more than 50% of his salary. And I realize that bonuses are paid as part of salaries, etc., etc. But it doesn't send the right message, does it, when you finish fifth and out of the Champions League for the first time, that your chief executive, who was nowhere to be found, literally nowhere to be found, during that difficult spell last season, he hid, and he gets a bonus of £1 million. And this is, it all ties into the way that this club is being run. So I don't like the way that Kroenke runs this football club. But I also see someone like Alisher Usmanov as as I mentioned in the blog the other day, if you're an opposition politician, right, it's easy to say the right thing. It's easy to promise the sun, moon and stars because you know you don't have to. An Usmanov can sit on the sidelines and say, well, I would do this, I would do that, I would do the other. But that's easy because he knows he's never going to have to put his money where his mouth is. And I don't buy the idea that Usmanov cares about the fans. You don't care about the fans. They don't care. Kroenke and Usmanov and none of these people who own these football clubs really care about the fans. He may have done us some service by not selling his shares to Stan Kroenke for the moment. But beyond that, we've no evidence that he gives a fuck. I mean, really. This is a man who made his fortune in the same way that Roman Abramovich did, and we're looking at Abramovich over the last number of years and being critical and pointing fingers. But because Usmanov is not Kroenke, and nobody likes Stan Kroenke, people are willing to overlook that, and I understand it. I completely understand it. If you were to say your football club's got to be owned by a good guy straight down the line, loves his wife and 2.4 kids, come on, that's not realistic. I know that. I know that people with big money and in big business are unscrupulous. I understand that. I know that it's completely unrealistic to think that Arsenal might have an owner or owners who would do everything out of love for the club, who would sacrifice their own fortune for Arsenal because they love it so much. There is no Arsenal billionaire philanthropist out there who's going to come in and save the day. I get it. But at the same time, can we not just have the conversation about the two people that own this football club, about the two men that own 97% of the shares in this football club? And if you could choose, would you not choose different people? Would you not choose better people if you could? I realize that we can't, and maybe we just have to get on with it. And I know that maybe the previous shareholders before the Kroenke and Usmanov era, some of them were involved in business practices that could be looked down on. Of course, I get it. But I don't think we should just blindly accept everything. That's my point. I think we should be able to talk about it and to express concerns and reservations about these things, even if we can do nothing about it. Maybe it's just a problem shared, is a problem halved and all that. We've got our own moral quandaries to deal with when it comes to our football clubs and who owns them and who runs them and everything else. Anyway, I'm kind of ranting a bit here, and we might talk a bit more about the ownership situation with our guest. But first, let's talk to him about finances, because that is what he does. He provides these forensic examinations of Arsenal's accounts and other teams' accounts as well. You'll know him off Twitter, at Swiss Ramble. Kieran O'Connor, welcome to the show.
Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Well, thanks. And Arsenal are in good shape financially. The results came out last week. They were leaked online, actually, weren't they? There was something strange went on. The results came out a bit early, but I suppose the bottom line is Arsenal are back in profit, and that's a trophy we can all celebrate.
Indeed it is. I mean, you say back in profit. The last time Arsenal made a loss was way back in 2002. So, I mean, to an extent, they've always been the poster child for football finance, which on the one hand is a very good thing because it's the sign of a very well-run club. On the other hand, I think everyone would like to see a bit more of that financial wealth out on the pitch. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these results showed that Arsenal still have a fair bit of cash, not quite as much as they had a couple of years ago, but still more than enough to buy, well, I was going to say two world-class players, but in the current market, let's say one.
Yeah.
But as you say, the results were pretty good. The profit before tax went up from 3 million last year to 45 million, which is impressive in anyone's language. I mean, to put that into context, there's only one other club that's reported its 16-17 results to date, and that's Manchester United. Now, their profit was a bit bigger at 57 million, but, you know, they are a cash machine. And if you look at the previous season's results, Arsenal's 45 million would have been ahead of all of them. Mm. And you know, to maybe put it another way, the 45 million last season was more than the previous four seasons' profits combined. So, you know, really spectacularly good performance. Revenue was up about 20%, which is worth 70 million to a record high, 423 million. It's the first time Arsenal's revenue has been above 400 million. It was driven by the Premier League TV deal. which was worth about another 40 million. And obviously, this is something that's going to benefit all the clubs when they announce their results. So it's a little bit misleading, Arsenal being so far ahead at the moment.
Yeah.
We also benefited from the Champions League. We got better distributions. There's a fairly technical formula to calculate the distribution of the TV money. One element of that is where you finished in the Premier League the previous season. So as Arsenal finished second the previous year, they got a bit more cash. The Brexit effect, you could call it, the distributions are paid out in euros, so in sterling terms it went up. So that was all good. Commercially,
well, can I just stop you, because I want to go on to some of those points. In terms of the profit, why was there a jump from 3 million to 45 million? Was that primarily down to the television revenue?
Yeah, it mainly was. So, you know, Warren Buffett, the great American investor, has a whole raft of great sayings, and one of them is a rising tide floats all boats. So to a certain extent, you know, Arsenal have benefited just from being in the Premier League, and, you know, we'll see other clubs benefit from that by at least as much. Chelsea's growth will be much higher because they went from eighth to champions, for example. The other element of the TV money, as I said, the Champions League. And, you know, that will hit us this year when because we've sort of dropped down to the Europa League, though I must say, as a fan, I'm actually quite enjoying the Europa League. I enjoyed the Cole match and the Batty Borisov extravaganza, you know, seeing some of the youngsters actually is sort of a bit more exciting in some ways.
It's just less familiar, isn't it? I mean, it's probably the first time ever that the word extravaganza has been used in relation to Batty Borisov, but I know exactly what you mean. Just by sheer virtue of being different, it's just a bit more entertaining.
Exactly. So, you know, financially, it's not great. The club has estimated that being in the Europa League on a net basis will cost us around 20 million. I think it might be a little bit more than that, but, you know, there's quite a few factors coming into play.
Would it be fair to say that if there was a time to drop out of the Champions League and into the Europa League, it would be fair to say probably it would have had a lot more impact a few years ago, but now, because of the increased television revenue from the Premier League, it means that the gap between the Champions League clubs and those below the Champions League is not as great as it was. So perhaps this is something that we're better able to take on board.
Yeah, I guess that's partly true. What UEFA did with the most recent TV deal was they deliberately gave a bigger slice to the Europa League to reduce that gap.
Right.
So that helps. The second element which helps this season is because United won the thing last year and so qualified for the Champions League, there are fewer English clubs, so you get a bigger slice of the pie. So from that perspective, you're right. I would say if we stay out of the Champions League for too long, it's clearly not a good thing, particularly when it comes to securing good commercial deals.
Yeah.
And this, of course, is Arsenal's Achilles heel when it comes to revenue.
Yeah, the commercial revenue did go up, but only by 10%. And you have a chart on the great Twitter thread that you did. You talk about the commercial revenues. I mean, they're behind Manchester United, and everybody understands that Arsenal are going to be behind Manchester United from a commercial point of view. But they're also a fairly long way behind Manchester City, which I thought was quite interesting. They're more or less the same as Chelsea and Liverpool. And we might talk about Arsenal's improvement, but I want to ask what in terms of the Manchester City commercial revenue, how... I don't mean to cast aspersions at Manchester City, but I mean, how legitimate is that? Because we know United have been a behemoth for years. They were ahead of the curve when it came to commercials. City have only been, I won't say a big club, but you know what I mean? They've only been around the top of the Premier League for maybe less than a decade at this point. So how have they built that amount of commercial revenue? And is it all above board, dare I say it?
Yeah, so I think you're right that the United are in a league of their own. They're about 160 million ahead of Arsenal, and there's no chance of catching them up. City, I would say there's a bit of a mixture. So it's clear that a lot of their deals have come from the country of their owner. So from that basis, you can say, well, that's not, you know, that's not necessarily something that you would appreciate. However, what they've done, which is quite smart, is they've got a lot of medium-sized deals. They don't have like one blockbuster deal.
Yeah.
So if you compared them with Paris Saint-Germain, for example, they have this like 200 euro million deal with the Qatar Tourist Authority. And that does have a bit of a smell about it, and UEFA did indeed punish them and say, look, that clearly is overvalued, mates rates, call it what you will. City also, I think, to their credit, have an excellent commercial operation. So they've secured a lot of the secondary sponsors that sort of build up, which has actually been the driving force of United. I mean, United have two great shirt deals with Chevrolet and Adidas, but they also have loads and loads of secondary deals, and this I think has been Arsenal's weakness. But I think the comparison that Arsenal the Arsenal board should really look at is with Chelsea and Liverpool. So yes, you're right, we got a 10% increase, which is pretty good considering that you know, none of that is an increase in the main shirt deals. However, it only brings us up to the same sort of level that Chelsea and Liverpool were last year. So you would expect them to be even higher when they publish their 16-17 accounts. And I think that legitimately we could aspire to be above them. And I think that it's a bit of an indictment of Arsenal's management, and I would actually say Gazidis specifically. I mean, I mean, the full Arsenal report was published yesterday, which revealed that Gazidis received a full package of 2.6 million, second year in a row. And I mean, he's trousered just about 10 million over the last 4 years, which, you know, it's nice work if you can get it. But I would expect, given his commercial background, that he would have done a little bit better than he has.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one, because you look at those things. I mean, clearly what happens on the pitch isn't necessarily going to be reflective of what the criteria were for his bonus. But if you're to talk about increasing the commercial deals, the sponsorships, people talk about why Arsenal don't have a shirt sleeve sponsor when many other clubs are having those. And I think the deal that they did with Emirates precludes any other sponsorship on the shirt at all. So was that something that was short-sighted, or you know, not knowing that this kind of thing was going to be allowed in the future? And how do Arsenal, an Arsenal that's fifth at this moment in time, playing Europa League football and already finding it difficult when they're in the Champions League and supposedly challenging for the title, they're finding it difficult to attract these sponsors. How are they going to do that when the stakes are a bit lower, when the stadium's a bit emptier, when the players on the pitch are maybe not as high quality as they might be?
Yeah, so I think there's two elements to that. The lack of sort of foresight in when they signed the deal. So when they signed the deal, it was actually pretty good in contrast to the others, and others have leapfrogged them since. But, you know, there are elements to that which you look at and you think, well, that's not so good. So Emirates bundling in the stadium naming rights, which go far longer than the shirt deal. I think they go to 2028.
Yeah.
But, you know, they've almost been given a freebie there, which is not great. The training kit lack of sponsor. I mean, United were the first to do that. I don't know for sure, but I would say it's almost certain that there's something in the contract that precludes a shirt sleeve sponsor. Otherwise, I think we would have one by now.
Mm.
I mean, you know, maybe people say, well, the Arsenal sleeves are traditional, we won't touch them, but I don't think so in this day and age.
No, I don't think so.
If I'm completely honest. And I mean, the second part of your question, I think, is the really interesting one, which is we've clearly weakened our hand when it comes to negotiating new deals by being out of the Champions League. So success on the pitch is one element, but also talent on the pitch and stars. I mean, this is one of the reasons why United, for example, invested so much in Pogba. And although it's a bit cheesy, his old brand and the emoji and all that stuff, it does help them commercially. And if you look at where we are now, every chance that by the end of this season, if not before, Sanchez and Ozil have gone, it's not as if we have much, you know, left in the form of talent or star quality. I mean, it might be a good team, but that's not the same thing for the commercial sponsors. I mean, the interesting thing is that Arsenal make great play of what they call the virtuous circle, which is sort of blinding common sense, really. They say if you have more on-field success, that will increase the fan base and the engagement from the fans. That will in turn increase the revenue, which will give us more money to invest in the team and produce more on-field success. But at the moment, you know, one rather important part of that is a little bit broken, which is the on-field success.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel like they've always been doing what they can to repair the circle. If there's a little, maybe it's a triangle at the moment. I don't know what it is, but it also suggests maybe that, you know, that's an issue that they can address as a football club. But I do wonder if perhaps in terms of staff, in terms of commercial directors, in terms of what we've got at board level, whether those are things that could also help improve the results in those regards. I mean, of course, everything stems from the pitch, but if you've got a really shit-hot commercial dude who can go out and do lots of good deals, that would certainly help offset that.
I think that's a good point, and you only have to look to the northwest, i.e. Liverpool have secured good commercial deals when they've been out of the Champions League for many years. United also have had a couple of years ago they were out of Europe altogether, and they were still raking in the deals. Now you can argue they're a special case because of their history, you know, Munich, Busby Babes, etc. And I think there is something in that. But what they do have is an extremely smart commercial operation. It's a big operation. They have a lot of people in there. They have sort of regional offices. They have a Swiss office in London. So that they invest a lot of money in it, but they really do produce and deliver. And I think, you know, Arsenal traditionally are a club that are not overly ambitious. And I think you see that a little bit in the transfer market. I think you also see it off the pitch in the commercial operation.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see if that's something that is addressed. And normally that's something that would come from on high, very, very high. But that's Stan Kroenke, and that might be something we touch on in the conversation in a few minutes' time.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/arsblog.
Wages is something that people look at all the time and say, generally speaking, your wage bill should more or less tell you where you're going to finish in the table. So the, you know, the big teams have the biggest wage bill, and the teams with the biggest wage bills generally finish near the top of the table. There's a real outlier there, as much as it might pain me to say it, in that Tottenham's wage bill is what, maybe, where was it here? Okay, £100 million. Arsenal's is just £200 million. And we're not seeing the return for wages in terms of Premier League positions.
Yeah, so you're right. And studies over the years show there's a very strong correlation between the wage bill and success on the pitch.
Yeah.
Tottenham do get a lot of bang from their buck. You can see how painful it was for me to say that, but it's, sure, it's true.
Is it going to be a problem for them, do you think, given the increased stature that they have, and they've got some very high profile, very good players? And you think of Harry Kane, obviously, Dele Alli, who are probably players who merit greater salaries than they're on right at this moment in time at Tottenham.
Yeah, I think it will be a problem.
Good.
I must admit, I thought it would be a problem earlier. So I'm a little bit surprised that they've managed to hold their wage bill at that 100 level, 100 million level, really, for the last 4 or 5 years. But I do think now, particularly with some of the wage deals that are there, that it would be a surprise if players like Kane and Ali weren't tempted to move. And I think it comes back to also the sort of success issue. So if they don't win anything in the next two seasons, maybe even this season, I would say it would be almost certain that they would go, at least one of them.
Mm. Yeah, well, that might help their wage bill or help bring things back in line. I mean, is it a case that Arsenal's wage bill, when we hit the end of this current season, is going to take a dip as well, particularly with players that have left this summer? And, you know, with talk of big extensions for the likes of Alexis Sanchez and Mesut Ozil, they have not materialized.
No.
And those are, you know, had they happened, we would see Arsenal's wage bill even higher.
So I would be really surprised if it went down. I think there are a number of reasons why it hasn't gone up as much as people might have expected. The obvious one is the lack of qualification for the Champions League, so no bonus payments for that. That's probably, I would say, around 10 million that would have been there if we, you know, qualified for that competition as we normally do. The other issue is, I mean, people label it financial fair play, but it's actually the Premier League's version, which is known as short-term cost control. And what this basically is aiming to do is to say, all this lovely additional money we get from the Premier League TV deals would normally just flow into the pockets of the players and agents. So to prevent that, what the Premier League have done is said, you can only increase your wage bill by a small amount, which is now 7 million a year, unless you increase your revenue by means other than the Premier League TV deal. So what that would mean, for example, is match day.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any of us would want to see that go up, because it basically means ticket price rises.
Yeah.
Or Champions League. Well, that's not going to happen. Player sales that they throw into the mix. And again, you know, do you really want to sell your best players? So it brings us once again back round to the commercial issue. And that's why clubs like United and City haven't really struggled with wages, because they've, you know, their commercial revenue has been growing like billy-ho, so they still have some space in the wages. I think also, you know, if Ozil and Sanchez go, you would have to hope that they would get replaced by players of a similar caliber, and they're not going to be cheap in terms of wages either.
It's a good point. And I don't know, I was thinking about that a bit earlier, and how when it comes to next summer, are Arsenal going to cope with the loss of those two players and the two star players, like you say, the impact that it would have on the club from a commercial point of view, a reputational point of view. It feels to me like Arsenal need to do something in January. And I know it's not the ideal time to buy players, but I think if you are at the point where you're accepting Sanchez and Ozil are going to go, I'm probably going to go in the summer, even if you would be keen on selling them or open to selling them in January, the players themselves might want to wait because they can leave on a Bosman and get the signing on fee. So it feels to me like Arsenal need to do something in January. Let's say go and get Thomas Lamar in January, because you've got time to prepare rather than doing it all at the last minute, as seemed to happen at the end of the transfer window this summer. In terms of what Arsenal have available to them in transfer revenue, there is cash there.
There is cash. So, I mean, if you look at the balance sheet, there's 180 million. It's a bit lower than the peak in 2015, which was about 230 million, because we have actually started to spend money on players in the last 3 years. There's been a really significant increase compared to the few years before that. But that 180 million, as the club is at great pains to emphasise, is a bit deceptive, because you have to take off things like a debt service reserve, which is about 36 million. Mm. There's money owed on transfers, etc., etc. And it's one of those questions that people often ask me. They say, how much cash can we spend? And it's genuinely an impossible question to answer, because it depends on all sorts of factors, like, you know, do you sell players? Do you build stage payments into your transfers? Are you willing to take on additional debt? That said, right now, I would say that Arsenal could spend 90, maybe 100 million. And you know, without sort of worrying about any of the other sort of factors coming into play. Mm. The AST has done an estimate. We do work independently, but we quite often come up with similar figures. And I think I read the other day that they came up with 90 million as well. So it's in that sort of ballpark.
Right. Well, so certainly scope to do something in January, even if it's not the ideal time to bring in players. But, you know, I think
you could buy 45 Rob Holdings.
Well, there you go. There you go. Talk about putting an end to our injury problems. We'd have so much strength and depth. It would be amazing. I mean, where, you know, put your Arsenal supporting hat on to one side and imagine that you're now making some kind of a decision for Arsenal Football Club, and you're looking at the situation of Ozil and Sanchez. Would you be tempted to try and sell them in January? Yes. You would?
Without a doubt. I think that, I was disappointed, both from a sort of businessman's perspective and actually an Arsenal supporter's perspective, that we didn't sell them in the summer.
My thinking was,
you know, you're leaving 100 million on the table, which, you know, potentially goes down to zero if they run down their contracts. I mean, if we sell them in January, we might get a bit, but not as much as in the summer. And that's 100 million that could have gone on finding some good quality replacements. But I also sort of think that they're probably going to be disinterested. I mean, Ozil is carrying some sort of injury. I'm doing that quote box time, by the way. Yeah, exactly. Sanchez, I think, although a great player, has always had, he sort of plays for himself quite a lot. Mm. And I think that might help us. You know, if he's playing for himself and he gets a goal, fantastic. But I would have definitely sold them in the summer. And I think if the opportunity arises, I would sell them in January.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose in some way it depends on how the season is going and how they're performing. But there have been players in the past who've run their contracts down and ended up marginalised, I think it would be fair to say, in the final year of their contracts, because Arsene Wenger doesn't view them as players who are committed. And I think when it gets to the business end of the season, there's got to be that worry, doesn't there? That is a guy going to make a tackle? Is he going to give 100% in case he picks up an injury? Of course, that's the risk that they run as well, though, isn't it? When they decide they're not going to sign a new deal. Signing a new deal gives you some measure of security, gives you a wage increase. So, yeah. You know, it's on them to an extent as well. And just a final thing in terms of finances, you know, we as fans look at the team and we can always see somewhere that we could view more investment as being worthwhile. But Arsenal have spent in the last 3 years, and I know the ball or the goalposts have moved considerably this summer, and it probably doesn't sound like a huge amount of money anymore, but £203 million on transfers in the last 3 years for a club whose, you know, I hate to say net spend, etc., was not always that high, or whose outlay even was not always that high. It's been a fairly free spending 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's very fair. And it's the last time I wrote a full blog on Arsenal, you know, as is my habit, I reach back to the 80s for a song title, and I went for New Sensation by In Excess. And what I actually meant was it was a new feeling, because Arsenal was spending money, big money, on players. And as you say, it's over 200 million in 3 years. It's over 100 million in the 16-17 accounts alone. And you know, I sort of looked at this over a long period, and obviously 200 million in 3 years, you're averaging just under 70 million a year. Mm. And in the 7 years prior to that, the average net cash outflow was just 5 million. So it's a really significant change. And when the club says, look, we are spending money, and it's a similar story, by the way, in terms of investment in infrastructure, they're right. So what has changed is that they no longer spend so much on just financing the debt and the interest. That is still a burden for us, by the way. We still have to pay out about 20 million a year on interest and loan repayments, which not every other club has to do. But it has come down. And the other thing that we've stopped doing is just building up our cash balance.
Yeah, yeah. But in some ways, though, it kind of feels like we're running to stand still as well, though, doesn't it? You know, we have increased the spending, but then so is everybody else around us. And maybe it's an illustration, Kieran, that while investment, of course, is important, it's not necessarily solely down to how much you spend. No. It's down to who is using the players that you spend the money on.
I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, I guess what was disappointing to people like me that were just looking at this cash mountain accumulating was that if we'd spent it at that time, it would have gone an awful lot further, both in terms of, you know, how the transfer market inflation has taken the prices to an astronomical level. And also just in terms of some of the currency moves. I mean, you know, many of the players we buy are from abroad. And if you look at the euro exchange rate and what's happened to that, you know, the poor old pound in your pocket doesn't go quite so far. So I think, you know, that was disappointing. But also, if you're going to spend, you have to spend it intelligently. It is, to be fair, more challenging for English clubs. I mean, people will sort of point to clubs like Juventus and others on the continent saying, look at, you know, these great players they've picked up for, you know, 10, 15, 20 million. I mean, the reality is that as soon as an English club, particularly a big one, walks through the door, the price goes up. You know, it's a bit like that TV show. Is it Harry Enfield? Where they say, oh, I see you coming. Yeah. They see an English club coming, and then they sort of say, right, you know, he's your price.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's definitely a challenge, and I think it's a challenge for all the English clubs, and it's I think there are challenging times ahead for Arsenal from a financial point of view and how it's managed on and off the pitch. Well, look, thank you for the insight into the finances, and we might move on and talk a little more generally about Arsenal. As a fan of I would be fair to say a fair few years at this point.
Since 1970, so yeah, a fair few.
Okay, well, that's a fair few. I'm being really, you know, diplomatic here.
Generous.
Okay, that's even better. How are you viewing what's going on at board level now? I mean, can we draw any kind of line between the fact that there could be improvements at board level and executive level, and the current unhealthy situation that we have between the two majority shareholders at the football club?
Well, it certainly doesn't help. And we have these two majority shareholders, as you say, but really all the power lies with one, which is Stan Kroenke, who has a, you know, 67% stake. I mean, the board, I mean, they might all be fine gentlemen with great records in the city, but you know, really Stan calls the shots. I think you were probably the same. At the time that Kroenke arrived, I had a pretty favourable impression of him. I thought, he's a guy that's involved in sport. He has a lot of teams. He seems to be an owner that's not going to intervene and come in shouting the odds and waving a big stick. And I thought that was probably what we needed. But I think over the years, he's revealed himself to be someone that seems to be uninterested in competing at the top level. He's obviously very interested in competing in the Premier League and accruing the riches that come with that status. But it just doesn't feel like he's willing to even invest the resources we have, let alone put in any additional funds to take us to the next level. And it's interesting, really, because you say take us to the next level. Arsenal have the seventh, even before this year's jump, had the seventh highest revenue in world football. So you think, well, that's fantastic. But it's just that those clubs above them are clearly a level beyond. And for us to get there, I think we would need an owner with a lot more ambition than Stan Kroenke.
It does mean something as well, doesn't it, when the owner is ambitious? Because I like you, you know, when he came in, it was the idea that, well, here's an American guy, what does he know about the Premier League? But if he's going to let the club run the way it has been run, and from that business point of view, for the most part, you'd say it was a well-run club. It was trying to prepare for financial fair play. It was living within its means, living within its natural resources, and spending the money that it generated. But if you have somebody with more ambition, they could perhaps put some pressure on. Take that risk in the transfer market. Don't build up the cash reserves. Be a bit more ruthless when it comes to certain players. Okay, yes, you've had your time, but now look, you go and we'll move you on for X amount of money. We'll spend a bit more money and bring in somebody better. And I think we've ended up in this kind of comfort zone from top to bottom, where nobody really is putting pressure on anybody else. And all the pressure that comes on the club is external. It's from fans, it's from media, but internally it doesn't feel like those pressures are there.
Yeah, it does feel very samey. And you know, I must admit, this season I've sort of found it quite difficult to get excited, even when we play well, because I just sort of think, well, it's going to be Groundhog Day again. And I think that people sort of look at what could possibly change. There's obviously been a lot of talk about Arsene and you know, whether he going might be the catalyst for change, and perhaps it would, but you know, at the same time, you'd still have the same board, the same governance, the same infrastructure supporting him, and the same, as you put it, lack of pressure to excel. And, you know, arguably you can say, when you look at Arsenal's financial resources, you know, we've performed at least at par, probably better than par most seasons. But there's always been that sort of nagging feeling that if we just did a little bit more. I mean, how many times have people said, if we just had two more players, this would be a Premier League winning squad? Yeah. I think we need rather more than two at the moment, but there were many years when it was always two. And Kroenke, I think, unless the Leopard dramatically changes its spots, is not really the owner that is going to provide that sort of impetus.
Arsene Wenger, you mentioned Arsene Wenger, and I've been of the opinion that Arsenal could use a new manager for a little while, but he obviously decided he wanted to stay, and Stan Kroenke decided that he wanted him to stay. And despite the fact that I'd like to see someone new in charge, there's a part of me that is slightly terrified of it. Not because of change itself, but because I fear that maybe as a club we are not set up for it or ready to make the transition from a manager like Arsene Wenger, who does so much, to the next generation of young, dynamic coach who's going to need more people around him than we have at the club right now. We go back to the director of football stuff, and I do wonder sometimes if Arsene Wenger's decision to stay was based on his perhaps belief that the club's not ready to take on a new manager in a way, that he looks at an absentee owner and he looks at a board that's made up of some old men, an Ivan Gazidis, and a young man in Josh Kroenke, who, again, probably has no real knowledge of Premier League football beyond what he's picked up from the odd board meeting when he's over. And I think that's it's certainly something we've got to give consideration to.
Yeah, and I think that the if and when Arsene does go, that the club would not really just be replacing him. As you say, they would have to replace in a number of other key posts. Scouting might be one. Academy might be another. Chief executive, I'm really not sure about Gazidis, because sometimes I think, well, he really should be an awful lot more effective than he is. At the other on other occasions, I think he looks like a man whose hands are tied, and he's operating within a certain set of constraints. And if he was allowed to break free, maybe he'd do a lot better. Maybe he'd be able to bring in a quality director of football, for example. And so you're right. There are a lot of imponderables about it. After many, many years, I basically sort of came to the same conclusion as yourself. I thought that we should have a change of manager. That doesn't mean I'm a sort of, you know, rabid Wenger must go. But I just feel like the club needs a change. And I would fully acknowledge that that might be a change for the worse. But I just don't really want to go through the same sort of seasons as we have been doing for the last few years. I mean, winning the FA Cup's great. And you know, people who support other clubs would be perfectly entitled to say, look, you know, that's great. You know, what are you complaining about?
Yeah.
But it just feels like the club should be aspiring to do a lot better.
Yeah. It's always struck me that considering the ambition it took to move from Highbury to the Emirates, the financial constraints, I think, is a polite way of saying what we did from a financial perspective. They were shackles. You know, the club was hamstrung for years financially just to get the money to move to the new stadium, to compete, to put yourself in the same league as the big European clubs, to try and compete for the best players. And it feels to me like the people who came in after the stadium were built, they're Kroenke, they're Gazidis, you know, for the most part, all those old board members were gone. And these guys arrived and they had this beautiful new stadium and they had this massive, you know, match day revenue and new sponsorship deals and new corporate revenue. And they kind of felt like it felt to me like they coasted rather than continuing to push the ambition that got us from Highbury to the Emirates. They went into it thinking, well, job is done and we'll just continue along like this.
I think that's very true. And you're right to draw attention to the fact that it was extraordinarily ambitious to do that move and to do that stadium move at such a high cost, keep it within Islington, you know, whereas the easier move might have been to move it elsewhere, but it was good to stay close to Highbury, and all the time maintain a really good standard of performance. I mean, all those years qualifying for the Champions League with those financial shackles. I mean, there was money available, but not as much as there is now, clearly. They built not only did they build a great stadium, but they built a perfect foundation as a launch board to go to that next level. And they just didn't make the move.
Yeah. I think that's the the really disappointing part for me, because now it feels like you've lost momentum. You've got to take a step backwards or another step backwards before you can start going forwards again. The last thing I just want to ask you about is what's gone on this week. Obviously, Alisher Usmanov has changed his position quite markedly from the one he held just over a year ago, where he said he had no intention of ever selling his Arsenal shares. And now he's open. He would consider selling his stake if he could find somebody who shared his vision for what the club might be.
For the right price. Oh, sorry, the right person.
Well, exactly. Exactly. I think we can read between the lines there that if the money is right, he's open to selling. And I don't think that precludes Stan Kroenke, despite what people might like to think. I don't think that danger is particularly gone yet. But from a business point of view, he's in a really unenviable position, isn't he? He owns 30% of something fantastic from which he can get no value or no joy unless it's monetary by selling.
Yes.
He can't be involved. Kroenke won't let him be involved. And even if somebody, you know, let's say you or I, Kieran, the Euro Millions comes up and we win it 5 weeks in a row and we go and we say, we'll buy those shares off you, we're going to end up in the exact same position. Mm-hmm. Despite how much noise we might make, Stan Kroenke will say, well, good for you. You've got 30%. I've got 67%. You can sit over there. It feels inevitable, really, that if Usmanov has any ambition to do anything in English football, that it's got to be somewhere else.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most likely outcome. On the other hand, he might just stick it out and think at some stage Kroenke might just sell to me.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Maybe it's because, you know, he loses interest, or he needs the money for investment in his NFL team or whatever. You know, you just hang on because you think, well, it would be really terrible if I went and then somebody else came in and bought it from under me. I think the chances of Kroenke selling to Usmanov are really low. But, you know, then again, you think, well, one of the main reasons that Kroenke bought into the club is clearly the TV rights, which may be a bubble that bursts, but not quite yet. And, you know, there's talk of new companies coming into the frame, you know, Netflix, Facebook, etc. So I think for a while there's still mileage in getting more TV money, and the regulations from UEFA and indeed the Premier League are helping clubs make profit. So, you know, Arsenal made a big profit. I would expect almost all the other Premier League clubs to also make money when their results are announced. And you know, at the moment, there's not really an obvious way for an owner to get the money out. I mean, Kroenke obviously had 2 years where he charged $3 million for his advisory fee. He stopped doing that now, but, I mean, it's not huge money. If he were to buy out Usmanov and get to 100%, he could then compulsorily purchase the other shareholders. He would have the freedom to do pretty much what he wanted, because the one good thing that Usmanov does now is he blocks any so-called special resolution, which needs a 75% majority. So Kroenke with his 67% is just short. And the sort of thing that he could do with a special resolution is start to pay out dividends, for example. I mean, United already do that.
He could borrow off the asset value of the club as well, could he?
Yes, exactly. There's all sorts of things he could do. He could delist the company, so you would have less transparency. He'd stop the AGM. I mean, whether that's a major loss, I'm not so sure, because it's stage managed to within an inch of its life. But there are a lot of things that he could potentially do, which I don't think us fans would like to see.
Right. Well, look, we'll have to see how it plays out over the coming months, and who owns all the shares by the end of the season. We'll just have to wait and see. But as ever, Kieran, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much indeed to Ciarán. You can find him and all his amazing work on Twitter at Swiss Ramble and on his blog, which is swissramble.blogspot.com. He looks at the finances of not just Arsenal, but lots of other clubs besides. And if that's your bag, then there is a treasure trove of information and blog posts for you there. So check it out, swissramble.blogspot.com. Right, going to leave it there because there isn't really very much to talk about, given that it is an interlull. There's no football going on apart from international football. And I'm not sure I can be arsed with much of that. Not this evening, anyway. James and I will be here on Monday. We'll have an Arscast Extra for you, but for various reasons, we won't be able to record that until Monday evening. So we're not going to have it for you until Monday night at some stage. Probably, I would say, around 10 o'clock, because we're not going to be recording till about 8. So sorry to disrupt your schedule, but there you go. Sometimes stuff is just out of your hands and out of our hands, but we'll cope with the chaos around us. Have yourselves a great weekend wherever you are in the world. Stay happy, stay safe. I'll catch you on Monday with James. Until then, cheers. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.